Welcome everybody to the next lecture of Architecture of Supercomputers. And before we start with the actual lecture, I would like to introduce you to a different subject. In about 1.5 weeks, I'll be flying to New Orleans to a conference and also to a competition, to the student cluster competition. Does anyone of you know the student cluster competition? Okay, that's good, so I won't be boring you with the details. The student cluster competition is an annual event where teams from all over the world compete for about a week to compute as much workload on their self-designed cluster computer. And it always takes place in the US during the supercomputing conference. And this year it is in New Orleans. Last year our university was participating for the first time. And last year the competition was in Denver. And we are currently seeking new students for the student team, because it's always difficult actually to find students, which surprises me, because in essence, students get paid for the whole trip, right? They get the trip for free, and the competition is a lot of fun. Perhaps the reason why it's hard to find students is that it's also a lot of work. But I would like to show you some pictures of last year's competition to show that it's not just work, but it's also fun. This is a picture taken before we left Erlangen. We bought a new machine. So this looks actually pretty tiny, but it's a lot of equipment in pretty little space. We called our computer Siegfried, and our team was called Team Crowd Computing. So it was a bit of a pun on cloud computing, which was a huge hype last year and continues to be this year. So this is actually Chris, who is applying the Chris and Lucas, who were applying the name to the machine. And these are some more pictures of the preparation. Most of the students were from the computational engineering course. But we also had one student who was studying, what is it called? Electrotechnik? Electrical engineering, thanks. And also one computer science student. When we got the machine, it was packed in this large box. Our problem was we got the machine so late that we couldn't ship it with the usual shipping service. So what we did instead was we packed it into smaller bags, and I took it with me on the plane, which was afterwards pretty crazy, because it doesn't look that much, but it was close to 100 kilograms, so it was really a lot of weight. And I even bought a handcart to pull it along, which seemed easier than it actually was, because these wheels work very good on solid ground. When you go outside, it's not always solid, it's not always very flat. So it was difficult. But yeah, this is again in Erlangen at the bus stop, which was the first challenge. And this is already a picture in Denver when the bags came through the bulky luggage band. And actually, I had to wait 30 minutes for the bags to arrive. Hi. So I was already worried, and I was already thinking, we won't get our machine. The problem was the machine was worth about $40,000. So losing it or breaking it was absolutely not an option. So I was really, really nervous. This is another picture. The one of the benefits of traveling is that you get to see some beautiful sights. So I think this is again a bus stop. This is in Denver. It looks a bit nicer than the bus stop in Erlangen. But my problem was actually I was waiting on the wrong side of the airport. So I was waiting for my bus and was worried why it wasn't arriving. And after 30 minutes, I thought, okay, maybe I should ask someone. I asked someone. They didn't know anything. I'm currently talking about last year's student cluster competition. We are trying to attract new students. And then I realized, okay, I need to go to the other side of the airport. The problem is Denver is not a very large airport, but it's still large enough when you're carrying so much luggage. So it took me, I think, 20 minutes to get to the other side of the airport, which did also look very nice. After a couple of hours, I arrived in my hotel room and stacked all my bags there. And I was really tired. So the next day, when I met with my students, I said, okay, now you are pulling it along. I won't be doing this any longer. This is the convention center in Denver. What you need to know about Denver is they are also calling it the Mile High City, because its elevation is about 1,500 meters, which does not sound very much, but if you arrive there and you're not used to that, you will always feel slightly out of breath. And it gets even worse when you're pulling so much luggage. So that was one further reason why I was glad that my students were doing it. If you've ever been to a scientific conference, you may know that conferences are typically large rooms where people give talks. One difference to the supercomputing conference is that it also has a large show floor where companies exhibit their products. Supercomputing is not a large market, but still a lot of huge companies like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, NVIDIA are all exhibitors there, even Microsoft, although Microsoft is not a typical high-performance computing vendor. So when we arrived there, the hall, the exhibits hall, was huge, and we first needed to find where our booth was before we could get our equipment there. And these are some impressions. So actually, even American universities are exhibitors there. So for instance, here you can see Stanford. Just below that is Tech. That's the, I think, Texas Advanced Computing Center. And there's one part of the show floor is reserved for the student cluster competition, and each team gets its own booth here. So if you go to the Fachschaft Computational Engineering, you will see this sign in their room because they took it with them when they got back to Germany. This is a map of the show floor. And I hope it gives you some impression how large the show floor really is, because these larger booths are, if I recall correctly, about 8 meters by 8 meters. So the whole floor is really, really large. This year, our university won't have its own booth, at least not the university itself. Of course, our student cluster competition team will have its own booth, but not the university. But we will still have an exhibit, and Konstantin will manage one of our demos, which we will show in cooperation with the Louisiana State University. I probably should have brought the new map for this year so I could show you where you will be with the LSU booth. But I don't know that yet. I think it's available online. Okay, some more impressions of the show floor. One interesting point was one of the sponsors for the HPC showcase was John Deere. I was not aware that John Deere had the company had anything to do with high-performance computing, but apparently they are testing their new designs first on the computer. So they don't build the new lawnmower directly, but they test it on the computer how good it works. And that's actually true for a lot of companies. So one reason why supercomputing, or at least the high-performance computing market, is constantly growing is that more and more companies realize that it's costly to build prototypes, so they build them first on the computer. That's cheaper. This is last year's LSU booth. So the Louisiana State University is the university we are usually cooperating with. And the funny thing is, usually even they have to travel across the American continent to get to the competition or to the conference. But this year, the conference itself is about 100 miles from Baton Rouge. LSU is in Baton Rouge, which is also Louisiana, and New Orleans is just 100 miles from there. I said before that many companies have their own booth. This is the booth of SUSE, one of the major German Linux vendors. It's not very impressive. I'm not sure if they arrived. So this is another booth, which is probably more impressive, from Extreme Networks. I don't even know that company, but they are there every year. And they always have this huge truck, which they drive onto the actual show floor. So you have to imagine there's carpet everywhere. And they drive with this truck. The truck is extremely clean, so I'm not sure if the truck ever hits road or if they put the truck on another truck to get it somewhere else. I'm not sure. It always looks so clean. And they always have a bar inside. So in the evening, they usually serve drinks. So someone described once the supercomputing conference as Burning Man for geeks. It's probably something like that. This is the NVIDIA booth. As I said, some companies have really large booths. And NVIDIA usually hosts talks on the conference and also gives tutorials. And they always hand out green scarves. So at the end of the conference, you'll see a lot of people wearing green scarves. One thing that changed in the last years was the US Department of Energy, which is also one of the major funding sources for high performance and supercomputing. They reduced their attendance and also their booth size, simply because the Obama administration changed rules on business travels, and also some of the funding was diverted, so they right now don't have as much money. But it used to be, I think, 1/3 of the attendance at the supercomputing conference. You need to know that there are more than 10,000 people on the conference, so it's a really large conference. I think one third was funded by the Department of Energy. Yeah. This is a booth of the Tokyo Institute of Technology. I think I just took that picture because I once had an account on that machine. This is another picture. At the end of the student competition, someone decided it would be a good idea to pit the student teams against an all-star teams of professionals. And they wanted to see what would come out of this. And Cray was the hardware vendor or the hardware sponsor for the professionals team. Our team did not win the student cluster competition, but they won this Pro AM challenge. So they bet the professionals by a margin of, I think, 1 to 10. To be fair, one reason was we had two NVIDIA engineers helping our students. And the professional team got pre-release hardware, which they thought would be even faster than the current Intel hardware, but which actually didn't work very well. So they were handicapped, but I think our students did a marvelous job because they rebuilt the cluster in the last night before the Pro AM challenge. So they actually borrowed hardware from the Chinese team, which wasn't participating in this last challenge, and they changed all the InfiniBand hardware. So it was a last minute change because they were fearing that if the professionals team was able to harness, we didn't know their performance numbers, but we were trying to estimate their peak performance, and we were fearing that they would overtake us. So we decided to do a gamble, and it actually worked out. So even if the professionals had been able to use the hardware to the maximum, they probably would not have won. Yeah, but that was really satisfying because I think the students were a bit sad that they didn't win the competition. They finished third place overall and second place in LINPACK. So it was a good thing to at least win something. I took this picture. I think the locals didn't mind, but there was a group of Canadians standing behind me who were also laughing at that sign. Okay, so yeah, some geek jokes everywhere. I'm not sure, this is, I think, a Japanese project. I'm not sure why they decided to name it. I don't even know how to pronounce it. I won't pronounce it in the lecture, but yeah, some funny things happened. This is a booth of another team. They decided to write their root password on a napkin and did leave it at the booth without being manned. So This is the Chinese team. When the Chinese team arrived, we were surprised because they had a lot of equipment. Most teams had all their equipment on one pallet. I think the Chinese team had 3 pallets, so a lot more equipment, which was good because later on we could borrow some equipment. And the first thing they did was they tore it all apart. They opened all the boxes and removed all CPUs, and later on we learned that they were only doing this because Inspur, the sponsor, had supplied them with new CPUs, which had just been released. So they were performing CPU upgrade, which we thought was risky, but it all worked out. So they were very disciplined, and I think they finished second place. I'm not sure. They at least they won the Linpack. So yeah, it was very impressive to see them do all these late night changes. Our team was having troubles as well. So some of the pictures show this. The students here in the picture work together a lot, and I think they are friends. But after the competition, they said, "We need some time out." But it's all good now again. So these are actually our sort of bigger brothers. So perhaps some of you know Professor Wellein and Dr. Georg Hager. They are working in the High Performance Computing Group. I learned a lot from them. And they were participating in a different challenge, the Intel Parallel Universe Compute Challenge, some cryptic long name. It was a combination of a programming contest and a trivia quiz. So in each round, they would pit 2 teams against each other. And in the first minutes, they could score points in a trivia quiz. So there were questions like, who was the vendor of the fastest machine at this and that conference, or which language was used for some simulation code. So very, very, actually very difficult questions that you only know when you've been in the scene for a while. And the second part was always a programming contest where they would supply the team with an existing code, and they had to optimize it live. So the audience could see both screens of both teams and could see how they were changing the code. And they had a second window where they would compile and benchmark the code on one workstation, which was supplied by Intel. So you could always see how they optimized performance. And that was really, I think, challenging for the teams, and was also good for the audience because you could always see how they were improving and sometimes catching up with each other. And actually, the German team won, so everyone was very happy, and our students were cheering for them. So that was funny. It was also sometimes a bit unfair because some other teams did not have so many people who were rooting for them. So sometimes it created the impression that all the audience was just rooting for the German team, which probably was not a fair representation. Yeah, and I think this is when they won the whole competition and got the prizes. I'm not sure. Oh yeah, right. They called themselves Team Gaussian Elimination after the algorithm. But they also posted pictures on their Twitter account and called themselves Milky Way Elimination. And they, you know the chocolate in Germany, Milky Way? They did call themselves because I think the Chinese team called itself Tianhe, which is the Chinese word for Milky Way. The Texas team actually won the student cluster competition, and it's hard to say. They won because they were very well prepared. But one thing we always were surprised was there are 6 students on the team. So if you count 6 students, you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. They actually had a lot of advisors. So they were not just very well prepared, but they also had a lot of support from their advisors, which is probably the reason for this is probably that Tech has been competing in the student cluster competition for a lot of years. So they have a lot of institutional knowledge. They have a lot of experience. Right here, at this university, I'm the only advisor to the teams, and I've just been there one time, so we have a lot less experience. But we are trying to catch up, and this is actually one of the reasons why we are seeking new students. We would like to find more people who are interested in these competitions. And I said in the beginning, it's not just fun, it's also a lot of work, but I hope that the pictures did show you that it might be worth all this work. And actually, there's not just one student cluster competition. There's obviously the one at the SC. This is always in the US. It's always in November. But there's also the ASC. No one really knows what this stands for, because it's something like Asian Supercomputing or Community. And it's also a student cluster competition, so there's some C's or some S's are missing. But this is, I think, always in China. And there's also the, and this is usually in spring. And there's also the ISC, which is always in Germany. And of course, it would make sense for a German university to participate in the ISC student cluster competition. The ironic thing is we never participated. We never even applied. And this year we are trying to put together a team, but we don't have enough students. I think if you're studying computer science or computational engineering, that's a good background for this competition. So if you're interested, please get in contact with me. Actually, some students are sitting here in the front row who would like to participate, and they need some more students. I think we need how many? Five?
Five? We need in total six.
It's six.
Currently, we have four to five, depending on
okay.
One person.
Okay, so we are seeking at least one, better two students who would like to participate. One thing you need to know is, I think the application deadline for the SCC, which is now in November, was in June or July. So it's been a while ago. The application deadline for ASC is usually pretty late. This competition is in spring, but the application deadline is somewhere in December. So there's still some time. The ISC, which is in summer, has its application deadline in November. So actually in, I think, 1 or 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
In 2 weeks' time. So we really need to hurry. Writing the application itself is not that difficult, but obviously finding students is difficult. As I said, please get in contact with me if you are interested in this. Okay, so much for the pictures. Let's start with the actual lecture. I think last week we stopped here and we discussed hazards, how they happen in hardware and how they get resolved. And what I said last week was basically what we do is we wait. If a hazard occurs, we just wait. And that's not always very efficient. So to be more efficient, CPUs today use out-of-order execution, and we will take a brief look at the scoreboard algorithm to see how this works. Does anyone know this machine? This is the CDC 6400, and this is the CDC 6600. This was also called the first supercomputer by some, and it's actually the first, at least as far as I know, the first machine which implemented out-of-order execution. It was built in 1963, and how its own implementation of the scoreboard algorithm works is what we'll see in the next slides. Does anyone know how long it took Intel to implement scoreboarding in one of their processors? So as I said, the CDC 6600 was built in 1963. Okay, please guess. When did Intel introduce out-of-order execution in their CPUs?
85?
85, okay. Another guess? Actually, it was 1995. That was the Intel Pentium Pro. That was released 1995. So it took them more than 30 years to implement this. And okay, the Pentium Pro was a commodity processor, was a consumer market processor, and this was a supercomputer. So two interesting things. First of all, today it's unthinkable that Intel would take 30 years to implement some optimization of the competition into their own processors, because today they are leading the market. So such a thing would never again happen. Another interesting thing is, this was again an optimization driven by supercomputers, which trickled down to the consumer market. That's another thing which is very unlikely to happen today. Now back to the algorithm. The scoreboard algorithm is basically a huge hardware table for all functional units, for all instructions, and for all registers to keep track of which instruction is generating which data, and which functionally, which registers are being written by which instruction. And one interesting thing is, in these slides, it's being said that the ID stage, the instruction decode stage, it would be split into two parts. But actually, the second part is just the operand fetch part. So I wouldn't say it's actually being split into two parts, but after the issue stage, which is the traditional decode stage, the read operand stage is just the OF fetch, the operand fetch stage. So obviously, the names of the instruction stages is not standardized. Okay, as we said last week, out of order execution and completion can lead to write after read and write after write hazards, simply because the same instruction might be writing the same target register, or I might be writing a register which is being read by another instruction, and where I need to keep track of the order. There are different types of solutions. In the scoreboard algorithm, we first read registers exclusively and keep track of preceding instructions and which instruction is writing which other register. And again, we introduce pipeline stalls if the dependencies are not fulfilled. The same for write after write. We detect the hazard and we wait with the write back until the conflict is cleared. We will see an example in the next slide. So these slides are primarily for your reference. You do not need to understand the algorithm now, but hopefully on the next slides. Okay. I hate animations. I'm sorry. When I took a look at the slides, I always take a look at the overview mode, and you don't see the animations there. So these are the different phases of the instructions. We first have instruction fetch, which is fetching per cycle just one instruction. This is actually different from modern CPUs, where we fetch multiple instructions in the same cycle. We decode one instruction. And in this example, we have four pipelines. So in the next part, when we fetch operands, we could actually fetch multiple operands in the same cycle. We have different functional units. This integer unit is actually also a load and store unit. So this is also used for memory traffic in this example. The floating point unit can perform multiplications. We have one floating point add unit and one floating point division unit. What we need to know is, in this example, add is a fast instruction, like it is in reality. Multiplication is actually slower. Current CPUs perform multiplication as fast as an addition. And division is very slow, which is still true today. So floating point division will probably remain a slow, at least if you are interested in the exact result, it will remain a slow instruction. And the last stage is the write back stage. So we have five stages: fetch, decode, operand fetch, execution, write back. One advantage of the scoreboard algorithm is that we can move instructions to different pipelines. So if we are stalling a pipeline, we are stalling just a single pipeline. So if the division gets stalled, only the division gets stalled, not the other pipelines. At least if the stall is introduced by the operand fetch phase. There are still reasons why the whole execution could be stalled if we are stalling here to resolve other issues, other hazards, sorry. So, and the scoreboard algorithm is now connected to every phase, here. Question, was it not connected to the execute phase? Because execute only happens when all source registers here are cleared, so there are no further dependencies to watch here. Any other hazards in the write-back phase are resolved here, so the execute units don't have to worry about that. Now, I said before that we need to keep track of the dependencies, and on the next slides we'll try to take a look at which variables we are actually tracking for each phase. This is more for our reference. So this is a detailed explanation of what I will be saying on the next slides. The second phase, as I said before, is actually the operand phase. So this only clears if all operands are valid. But let's take a look at this in an example. Okay, last stage, execution and write back. Now, what we are keeping track of, which data we are keeping track of, is the instruction state. So for each instruction, we need to keep track: is it currently in instruction fetch? Is it being decoded? Are we fetching operands? Are we executing it, or are we writing back results? For each functional unit, we need to keep track if it's busy, which type of operation, which instruction it needs to execute, which register we are trying to write to, which registers we are reading from. In this assembly code, we are assuming that they are always that they are at most two source operands. These variables, QJ and QK, keep track of which functional unit is generating my input registers, because sometimes I'm issuing a new instruction and its operands are not yet ready. So I need to look which functional unit will provide me with the operands. And last but not least, I will need to store two flags which show me if my source registers are ready, if I am allowed to read them. Sounds all more complicated than it actually is. So this is just the preparation for the example on the next slides. And of course, for each register, we need to keep track which functional unit is generating it. So to make it even more complicated, here's a table of all the logical conditions. You do not have to learn this for the exam. It would be nice if you could give me a short overview description of the scoreboard algorithm, but this is really just for reference. I think in the computer architecture course, we will not ask you for this table. Okay, as I promised, here is an example. I think it's easier to understand than actually the load of text on the previous slides. What we are trying to execute in this example is a short assembly program. And we will read two values from main memory and store them in registers F6 and F2. Then we will perform a multiplication, which multiplies F2 and F4 and stores the result in F0. We will also perform a subtraction, F6 minus F2, and store the result in F8. There is a division, which reads registers F0 and F6. So here we already have a data dependency, actually two. The load instruction is generating the result for the multiplication, and the multiplication is generating input for the division. And F6 is also something, a value generated by the previous load instruction. And last but not least, we have this add instruction, which is reading F8 generated by the subtraction and F2 generated by the load instruction, and it's writing to F6. And this is important because F6 is being read by the subtraction before, so I need to make sure that this add instruction is not writing back its results before the subtraction has read F6. Which sounds counterintuitive at this point because I see that add is being scheduled two cycles behind the subtraction. So I should assume that the subtraction has already read its operands, but as we'll see on the next slide, it may not happen. Okay, first cycle, nothing dramatic. The first instruction, the first load instruction is being issued. So the first integer unit, as I said before, is a load and store unit. It's now busy with the load instruction. Its destination register is F6, which matches this. And my source register is just R2. This 34 here is just an immediate value. It's not stored in an operand. So, and R2 is actually ready, so it may execute. And of course, we're also storing for register F6, that this is now being generated by the integer unit. In the next cycle, we are reading operands for the load unit. So this instruction enters the next stage. Now, one question, why doesn't the next load instruction now enter the issue phase? Reason for that is we have a structural hazard. In this case, we discover that the previous load instruction is still blocking the integer unit. So in this case, we now have to store the pipeline until the load load operation clears the integer unit. So we fast forward to cycle 5. The first load instruction finishes after cycle 4. Next load instruction gets scheduled in cycle 5. So again, the integer unit is now busy, but now it's generating F2. And it's reading R3, so different registers. But again, the source register is ready. Next cycle. In the next cycle, the load instruction reads its operands, and the multiplication is being issued. Multiplication is writing its result to F0, which matches this one here, and it will read F2 and F4. Now the question is, can I proceed in the next cycle? Can the multiplication be computed in the next cycle? And the result is actually no, because the second source register is ready, but the first one not. The first one needs to be written by, let's see, F2, by the integer units, the load and store unit. So this instruction here needs to finish first. Okay, next cycle. The load and store unit proceeds. It's now being executed. And the subtraction is now being scheduled on the add unit. The add unit usually can also compute a subtraction because it's basically the same function. But just like the multiplication, the subtraction cannot start because it's also waiting for one source register, namely for F2, which is also being generated by the load unit. Okay, next cycle. In the 8th cycle, I would now schedule the division function, the division instruction on the divide unit. But again, this is waiting for source registers, namely for F0. F0 is not ready because F0 is being generated by the multiplication, so probably this division needs to wait a couple of cycles. Okay, second part of cycle 8. The load instruction finishes. And now a lot of other instructions, actually both instructions here, the multiplication and the subtraction, may start in the same cycle because now all source registers are ready. I said before that add units, the add unit is much faster than the multiplication and the division. So in this case, we are here now noting how long they take for execution. Today, this would be different. On a modern CPU, addition, floating point addition and floating point multiplication are much faster than load. In this case, the execution of a load function took just one cycle. Today, main memory is not just one clock cycle away, but typically dozens of clock cycles, while multiplication just takes one cycle. But anyway, this is a historic CPU, so it works differently, that's okay. Okay, so both instructions start in cycle 9. We forward to cycle 21 when the multiplication finishes. So we can see the addition finished very quickly, but it's not clear to write back its result because it's writing register F6, and I'm not allowed to write this register because the subtraction hasn't read its registers yet. So we have to delay the write back of the add instruction until subtraction could read its results, and it can only do this if the multiplication has written back its results. Okay, next cycle. We can start with the division. And the division had to wait for input. Sorry, I was mistaken on the previous slide. I was saying that we are waiting for the subtraction, but actually here the division unit is now waiting, and it was waiting for F0. F0 is now the next cycle ready. So I think this is a mistake in the slide. So both input registers are now ready, and we will have to wait 40 cycles until the divide unit is finished. So we fast forward 40 cycles, and now all the operands have finished. So if we now take a look at which cycle, which instruction was finished, we can see that the out-of-order execution also results in an out-of-order completion. So usually we would assume that the first instruction finishes first. This is actually true. The second instruction finishes second, but the fourth instruction is in third place, and the last instruction already finishes after 22 cycles, even though the second last instruction finishes much later. This is typical for out-of-order execution. It shows that the architecture has gained some efficiency. It's probably not that obvious for just six instructions, but it works. And we can also see that this creates a lot of dependency issues and problems. So a lot of hardware today is devoted to the out-of-order execution. The next algorithm, which is an improvement upon scoreboard algorithm, is something we will not take a look on in this lecture. If you're interested in the Tomasolo algorithm, please visit the computer architecture lecture by Professor Dietmar Fey. We'll now just briefly skip through the slides. I did leave the slides in just in case you're interested. I will upload them, but it's not really relevant to this lecture. Basically, the difference between Tomasolo and scoreboard is it combines scoreboard with register renaming. So in some cases, it prevents a pipeline stall by simply copying the value of a register before. So as I said, if you're interested, please take a look at the computer architecture lecture or ask me in the exercises. It's not difficult to explain, but as you can see, it's a lot of slides and a lot of animations. Okay. This is the register renaming avoids a couple of hazards, but yeah, just assume it's magic that somehow works. This finishes our discussion of arithmetic logical units and CPUs in detail. I said in the beginning of the lecture that during the term, we will slowly zoom out. We were first taking a look at the functional units themselves, the control units, and now we are slowly zooming out. We are now assuming that the compute core is somehow doing its job with all the existing optimizations, and now we are moving out and taking a look at the interconnect, and more specifically on the memory subsystem, because any CPU can compute its computations, but it can't work when it's not able to access its data in time. So we are now taking a look at cache architectures. So the first slide says the processor and memory system determine the performance and cost of a computer. This is actually it sounds trivial, right? But for a long time, people were buying their computers by the gigahertz of the CPU. They were paying very little attention to the memory subsystem. And right now we are planning the acquisition of a new system for our chair. And one of my colleagues wants a system with at least 192 gigabytes of memory, which sounds like a lot, but the computations he's doing actually need as much memory. Now, the problem is 192 gigabytes of the memory we need for the system we are planning to buy costs about 4,000 euros. So that's as much as the rest of the system costs. So what I'm trying to say, today you really have to pay attention to what hardware you're buying. And if you need to become extreme in one side, it might cost you a lot. So what we are doing right now is benchmarking of the computations he's doing, so we can profile if this is actually the system we need or if we might get away with less memory and perhaps more scratch disks, so more SSDs. Now, usually when you are a programmer, you would wish that main memory is always large enough, that access to main memory is always as fast as the CPU, but that's actually not really realistic due to, as Dietmar put it, economic and technical reasons. Does anyone know why main memory is probably not as fast as the CPU? Do you know the law of Moore's law? So basically Moore's law says, it does, or perhaps we should start differently. People often think that Moore's law says that computers are getting faster exponentially, which is not true, because Moore's law just says that the density of the transistors doubles every 18 months. So that's different. And then in the past, it was true that actually by the shrinking of the gate sizes, we were able to clock CPUs faster. And this way, CPUs also got faster. But today, CPU clock speeds are limited. Even if you look at the fastest Intel CPU you can currently buy, it's, I think, clocked at 4 gigahertz. So somehow clock speeds have stagnated. The reason for this is if you clock your CPU faster, it also needs a lot more power. So today, what people are doing is they add just more cores. But even adding more cores increases the computational capacity of a CPU, so still performance is somehow growing exponentially on the CPU. Now the problem is bandwidth to main memory is also growing exponentially, but the factors are different. So we could say that the performance of the CPU is somehow growing with a factor F1, and we exponent this with t, the time, and the performance of the memory is also growing exponentially. The problem is F1 is strictly larger than F2. So this discrepancy between main memory performance and computational performance of the CPU itself is growing, and it will continue to grow. So that's one reason why we are interested in adding more caches, fast, small memories into the CPU where they can be accessed quickly. So this is also called a multi-stage memory hierarchy. So we have different stages. The lower stages are larger but faster. The upper stages are smaller. The lower stages are larger but slower. And the upper stages are faster but much smaller. So the programmer usually today has to decide where to place his data because placement really decides the efficiency of the program. Some stages we usually have, in pretty much every current architecture, we have registers and a level one cache. Most architectures, even GPUs today, have a level two cache. It used to be the case for a certain time that every CPU you could buy had a level three cache. Today, vendors are also selling CPUs without a level three cache because that saves die space, and die space is money. So it's basically a way to make money. Some CPUs have also a level 4 cache. I don't think any Intel CPU currently has a level 4 cache, but some IBM CPUs have a level 4 cache. That's basically an embedded DRAM in the chip module. Then there's main memory. There's also the disk cache. This is also called swap space. And everyone hates when the system goes into swapping because then it usually gets terribly slow. But there are some use cases for disk cache. So for instance, if you're running several huge applications which allocate a lot of memory but don't actually need it, this can be swapped out. Then we have disk space, which is usually some orders of magnitude larger than the RAM. This is sometimes wrong for supercomputers. Current supercomputers have petabytes of RAM, but also storage is a couple of petabytes. So there are not a lot of orders of magnitude between that, but they are somewhere in the same region. I put optical in braces because for a while it did look like optical data storage would replace tape. So when I was studying computer science, people thought tape was dead and all data would be put on optical disks. Then people realized that rewritable CD and DVD disks are not as durable as expected, but tape drives continue to increase their capacity. So today, tape robots are still being used in the RRZE, for instance. In our compute center, they have a huge tape robot, which is actually pretty impressive to look at because it is like a huge cupboard in which robot arms are moving and selecting tapes, moving them to the drives. And it looks a bit like, it is a robot, so it looks like it is alive in some way. Maybe I can ask Georg Hager to give us a tour again. Okay, I said before that today main memory is a lot of clock cycles, dozens of clock cycles away from CPU. This is a quick table which should give you an overview not just of the capacity. Actually, it's an older slide, so some of these sizes here might not match current designs, but I think it's somewhat okay. So here you can see that on the lower levels, we have much larger capacities, but also the latency, the time I have to wait from requesting data to when I receive it, is increasing. Actually, it's also increasing exponentially. So every data I already have in my register, I can use in the next cycle. For the primary cache, I have to wait a couple of cycles. This is actually increasing. So if you buy a recent AMD CPU, you have to wait, I think, at least 5 cycles from level 1 cache to register. So as the designs grow, as we add more complexity to the cores, also the data paths grow. Secondary cache takes more cycles. I think these cycle numbers have also increased. Main memory may today be as far as 100 clock cycles away, unless you're on a GPU where it is several hundred cycles away. So on the GPU, you even have to be more cautious. Background memory here, or archive memory here, we are measuring access time already in milliseconds, not in clock cycles. If you are relying on a tape robot, access time may even be in the order of seconds to minutes, depending on if your data is on the beginning of the tape or if the tape robot has to fast forward through the tape to find your actual data. So this may take really long. Okay, so the idea of a cache is to have a small and fast buffer between CPU registers and main memory to bridge the memory gap. As I said before, both CPU and memory performances are growing exponentially, but this gap will continue to increase. And currently there's no technology inside which would stop this. One idea is, does anyone know how a CPU is connected to the outside? Or did any one of you ever have a CPU in a sense? Okay, some people are nodding, that's good. So basically a CPU looks like this. It's a mostly rectangular chip. On the upper side you have a flat metal surface, and on the bottom side you usually today have golden dots, which are connector pads. They used to have small legs. So that was actually dangerous, because if you're not cautious handling your CPU, you might bend those legs and then you weren't able to mount them any longer. But if you look inside the chip, what you will see is there's a die inside, and all these connectors here are connected via bonding wires to the edge of the chip. Now, this doesn't look like a problem, but if we add more functional units here, the performance of the chip will grow proportionally to the number of functional units and their clock speed. But as the chip here grows, the number of bonding points I have increases just with the size of the with the extent of the external boundary. So it grows with the square root of the area, which is one reason why my connections to the outside are growing slower than my computational capacity. So this is a problem. Adding bonding wires or outbound connections just to the rim doesn't grow as fast as the computational capacity of the inside. One new approach is to not connect the outbound connections just to the boundary of the chip, but to have a true three-dimensional stack. So some of the new chips Intel is planning to release, I'm now drawing the die from the side. One of the ideas is not to add the bonding wires here to the side, but to have a 3D chip stack. So if this is a CPU, one idea is to place the memory chips directly on top of them. Of course, they cannot communicate through the air, right? So if they are creating such a stack, they need to connect those. And what they actually do is they create through wires. So they are bonding those in a three-dimensional way. And I think how it currently works is they actually drill holes inside the chips and then connect them through these holes. Does anyone see a problem with this 3D stacking? Yes, exactly. So before we had a lot of more surface, but now the chip, which is generating the heat, is generating the heat, and memory is also generating heat. So as I'm stacking more and more chips, I have less surface to remove the heat. So this again is limited. Maybe we can stack a couple of chips, but we then have an even larger heat problem. So it is definitely a promising architecture, but we can also already say that this again will be limited. So it's an interesting time to be now in parallel computing, because there are so many architectural changes, and it's hard to predict how computing architecture will look like in the next years. So okay, let's get back to caches. As we said before, caches are small and fast buffer memories close to the CPU. And they are organized in blocks. So these are usually called cache blocks or cache lines. There's a distinction between cache lines and cache blocks, which we'll see in the next slides. Okay, so as we said before, we will now assume that main memory is organized into multiple, in this case, lines. Usually you would say main memory is organized into words, but in this case we will assume that we have multiple blocks, which correspond to how long a cache line is. So actually, block length in this case is k words long. And the cache itself consists not just of the data, but also of a tag. This tag is later on used to decide which block in the cache belongs to which part of main memory. Okay, this is again an overview slide. One important thing to notice is if we have multiple cache levels, I have one problem. Usually, the CPU would be looking for some certain data point and would ask level one cache. Now, level one cache can either say, okay, I got this data and delivered, or it can say, I don't have it. But in the case of such a miss, if the data is contained in level one cache, we will call this a cache hit. If it's not contained, it's a cache miss. In that case, we need to ask level two cache. If level two cache doesn't have data, it's again a cache miss. So we ask level three cache, and if level three cache doesn't have data, we ask main memory. One problem is, if I daisy chain these cache levels on a cache miss, this will add a huge amount of latency, because I will first wait for this to fail, then I have to wait for this to fail, this will fail, and then this will deliver the data, and here data needs to travel across all three cache levels back to the CPU. So this is really slow. Another strategy would be to ask all cache levels simultaneously if they have a certain data element. This cuts latency, but it also increases cache traffic. So actually, Intel has this inclusion. So if you ask caches, they will subsequently ask the lower levels of the caches. AMD has a connected bus where all, at least they used to have it. I'm not sure for the current pile driver generation, but they used to have it for the older architectures where the CPU would ask all cache levels simultaneously for data and then take the first result arriving back. So depending on how the memory access pattern of a code is, sometimes codes ran faster on Intel, sometimes on AMD hardware. Today it's a bit different. Today most codes run faster on Intel hardware because AMD did lose its traction, which is a bit sad because I was always somewhat rooting for the underdog, and AMD used to be the underdog. But hopefully they will be able to recover with one of the future architectures. We will see. Okay. Oh, before we continue, these caches are all today on the CPU. It used to be the case that on very old hardware, when I got my first CPU, when I got my first PC, cache was sometimes on the main board. But today, all these are inside the CPU. Does anyone know why we don't build a level three cache? Why don't we build a level one cache which is as large as the level three cache, and which would then again be as fast as the level three cache? Because I'm spending that space on the die already, right? Why is the level three cache so far away from the CPU? One reason is level three cache is large, So the signals take some time to travel through the cache. And the speed of the signals is essentially limited by the speed of light. And if I build a huge cache, I will always have some delay. And I cannot afford the level one cache to be that large, because then I wouldn't be able to access its data in 1 to 5 clock cycles. That's one of the reasons. Okay. This is an example, I think, of the... It's probably not a specific CPU. This is how CPUs and motherboards did look like a couple of years ago. Does anyone know the major difference from this design and modern designs? Please?
Well, the Northbridge is pretty much gone, and the memory controller sits inside the CPU.
Exactly. So if you take a look at AMD performance counters, so inside the CPU, they will still often call some part of the CPU Northbridge. It used to be called this way because on the main boards some years ago, you had two major chips. One was the Northbridge, which was controlling memory slots mainly, and was connected directly to the CPU. And connected to the Northbridge was the Southbridge, which was attached to all the peripheral parts of the of your computer, like PCI slots, hardware, the BIOS. Was all connected to the Southbridge. And what people realized was the delay of data traveling through the net, through the socket of the CPU, through the Northbridge to main memory and back, was simply too long. So they moved parts of the Northbridge, almost everything, into the CPU. Does anyone know the first CPU or the first PC CPU vendor to do this? Today you would expect that this was Intel, right? Because Intel is leading the competition, but back then it was AMD. So there was a short time when AMD was actually delivering faster CPUs than Intel. It was just a couple of years, but in this time, Intel had a huge problem because AMD CPUs were faster and they were cheaper than Intel. So they were cutting a lot of revenue from Intel. And this even had an effect on the supercomputing market. Let me check. I think I got some statistics. Yeah, okay. So does anyone of you know top500.org? That's good. So what I didn't know was that they also had a lot of statistics which you can generate in a custom fashion. And what I did take a look at is the market share of AMD through time. So this is the list from June 2005. And what you can see here is the major CPU models are the Pentium 4. No one's using that anymore. The Xeon, so that's both Intel, Itanium, is also dead in the water. But it's all three, it's Intel. So almost two-thirds of the CPUs has been made by Intel. And what we can see here is, this is AMD's market share, 5% in 2005. That's not a lot, right? So not very impressive. So let's move to the year 3 years ago. 3 years on, 2008, and what we can see is the Opteron dual core is at 8.4%, so it's grown a lot. But actually, there's also the Opteron quad core, which has just hit the market, and which is at 2.8%. So in total, AMD is at slightly more than 11%. So it has more than doubled its market share in this time. So this was a good time for AMD because suddenly they were something and someone in supercomputing. Now let's move to the year 2011. Still, all the major systems are being made by Intel. So actually here, Intel's market share has even increased, right? This is, I think it's now almost three quarters of the market, quite a lot. But if we take a look at the Opteron, we can see quad cores at 4.4%, the newly released MagniCore system at 7.4%. So in total, AMD is still at standing at more than 11%. So they managed to hold their ground. Now let's move forward to this year, June 2014, and we can see Intel. So it's more than 75%. It actually, if we add up the numbers, it is more than 80%. Right. So this is really depressing. Now the second place doesn't even go to Opteron, but it is IBM hardware. This is the BlueJeanQ. Interestingly, BlueJeanQ is powering some of the fastest supercomputers. I think if you take a look at the top 10 systems, the dominant CPU vendor there is IBM, and most systems are BlueJeanQ systems. But IBM has already said that they won't build a successor to the BlueJeanQ line. BlueJeanQ is actually the third generation of BlueJean. So no one's really knowing what IBM will be doing afterwards. And here, this small part here, this is the MagniCore systems at 2.8%. And this here is another series of Opteron processors. So today, AMD is somewhere at 5%. So they really lost traction in the past years. A bit sad. Okay, so back to our caches. Okay, what caches try to harness is temporal and spatial locality. So temporal locality means it's pretty likely that if I just touched one piece of data, that I will touch it again in the next cycles. So for instance, if I have a for loop, the loop counter is something I might use repeatedly. So it might be sensible to keep this in a cache. Spatial locality is if I'm accessing, for instance, an array. Let's assume this is an array, and many programs will initialize arrays by running through them subsequently. So if I'm accessing this element, it is very likely that I'm accessing this or that element in the next cycles. That is called spatial locality. And caches try to exploit this by different strategies of placing data in the cache. So this is one figure to explain spatial and temporal locality. It is older than me studying. So this picture was there before I studied. I never really understood it, so we will skip through it. Okay, so cache types and arrangement. Primary cache has sizes of 8 to 16 kilobyte. I would say it's 8 to 64 kilobyte today. So if you take a look at AMD processors, their level 1 instruction cache is 64 kilobytes. Newer designs will have 96 kilobytes of instruction cache, which doesn't help them very much because AMD processors still have the problem of not being able to decode enough instructions per cycle. So if you take a look at performance results from AMD, for many codes, they will die on what we call front-end starvation. Front-end starvation means the instruction decoder is not able to supply enough instructions to the functional units per cycle. So the functional units are just sitting there idling, waiting for instructions. This is different for Intel. Much of the performance of Intel's processors comes from the excellent front-end design. So Intel's decoder and instruction scheduler is able to distill a lot of parallelism from a sequential instruction stream. Somehow I'm always pronouncing stream as scream. I'm sorry. Okay, small caches of 32 to small blocks of 32 to 64 bytes. I think in the PC world today, every cache line is 64 bytes. That somehow became a standard. It's different if you move to GPUs. It's different if you move to IBM hardware. But on the PC, it's almost always 64 bytes. Secondary cache is a bit larger. The size here, I would say, differs from 256 kilobytes for the level 2 cache. It may be a bit larger. Actually, such large level 2 caches have come out of fashion today, because today most CPU vendors, if they add larger caches, move those multiple megabyte caches to the level 3 cache. Blocks may be larger. Actually, this is not true for Intel. Intel always has 64 bytes on the cache line, but AMD has been using larger blocks for the upper layers. And larger caches are found for level 3 and level 4 caches. Usually those caches today are partitioned. So there's not one single level 2 cache, not one single level 3 cache. It's not monolithic, but its parts are connected via a ring bus or a crossbar network. What we could also say is, if you look at IBM processors, those have even larger level 4 caches. So they may be in the order of hundreds of megabytes. Does anyone know why IBM has such large caches on chip and why Intel doesn't? IBM is using a different manufacturing process. Intel caches are, at least until the last generation, have always been SRAM. Do you know how SRAM is built?
Just like a flip-flop?
Yes, exactly. So in a flip-flop, you typically couple two CMOS inverters to store one bit. So that would be four transistors. And for SRAM, you typically need two additional transistors to manage access to the flip-flop. So one SRAM cell. Okay. Do you know what SRAM stands for? Static Random Access Memory. Six transistors. It's difficult to put this into perspective if this is a lot or not. So let's compare to DRAM. Do you know what DRAM stands for? It's actually pretty logical. If you know that this is static RAM, this is dynamic RAM. So a DRAM cell, do you know how much hardware this needs? It's one transistor. And one capacitor. The reason why this is called dynamic RAM is dynamic somehow sounds better than static, right? But actually, this is not an advantage, but DRAM has the disadvantage that memory is not stored in a flip-flop, but it's actually stored in a capacitor. And every time I'm reading this capacitor, I'm emptying it. So after reading the DRAM content, I have to refresh it. So a DRAM unit or a DRAM memory will always need a read logic, which will copy what I'm reading to the output, but it also needs to write back what it just read, so that the read process remains non-destructive. This is why DRAM is called dynamic RAM, because I always need to refresh what I just read. One further disadvantage is this capacitor is leaking, so I cannot just write data to the DRAM and then assume that it will stay there forever. But the electrons are leaking from the capacitor, so I have to refresh it every couple of milliseconds. it doesn't sound very intelligent to use DRAM if you assume that it needs so much babysitting, right? But the advantage is that it uses a lot less hardware than the SRAM cells. One further disadvantage is that reading the capacitor takes a lot of time, because here the electrons stored need to move, right? SRAM is faster because if I'm using CMOS, I just have to work with voltages. I don't need to move, I don't really need to move electrons, but I just need to move the voltages. Now, the crucial problem IBM has solved is, usually when I'm creating DRAM cells, I'm using a different manufacturing process. So creating transistors, and especially the capacitor for a DRAM memory, is fundamentally different from creating logic blocks or SRAM. So Intel's problem used to be they were not able to implement DRAM cells on their chips because it used a different process, that they were not able to mix those. But IBM was able to combine both processes, and so they were able to use much larger caches. I said a couple of minutes ago that this has changed for current Intel design. So if you're buying a new notebook with a new Intel processor, you might have, I'm not sure if they are calling it or advertising it as level 4 cache, but it has the code name Crystal Lake. So this is an on-package, fast embedded DRAM memory, which is used for the GPU. It's a bit surprising they're using it just for the GPU, because it sounds interesting to a programmer, or at least for a high-performance computing programmer. But currently they're using this technology just for the GPU, maybe to get closer to the competition, because currently GPUs from NVIDIA are so much faster than Intel's embedded GPUs. Yeah, but probably the next architectures or the next processor releases will show if Intel's opening this on-die level 4 embedded DRAM to general purpose programming. This is another historical overview of CPUs and cache sizes. And you can pretty much tell in which year it was made. I'm guessing it was made 10 years ago. But it's also interesting because today, if you would look at current CPUs, you would almost only see PC CPUs. And back then, 10 years ago, you would also often see Cray CPUs, which were designed just for supercomputers. Cray is no longer designing CPUs. They have quit this because it was too expensive. So if you buy a Cray machine today, it will always be an Intel processor. You could buy AMD systems from Cray some years ago, but as we've just seen on the statistics from the top 500, you can't any longer. This is one reason why AMD lost so much market share in the supercomputing market. Now, I think we've now established the idea that we need caches, and that caches are fast, and they are somehow structured into blocks. So what we did not establish until now is how they actually work. Okay, so the first obvious thing to start with is a control unit. You always have a control unit, right? If you're trying to do something, you always need someone to take care of what's actually happening. So the control unit needs to determine if the data is available. This is what we call a cache hit. And if it's not there, we declare a cache miss. By the way, on the next slides, we will often write a cache as this, which is a dollar sign. Doesn't make sense, right? But in the United States, a dollar is cash. And this is, of course, pronounced just like our cash. Please do not pronounce the cash, the quick memory, as cage. A lot of people pronounce it as cage or cache. which sounds fancy, but no one will understand you if you are talking about caches. I'm not sure what the French pronounce it as cache. I never had French. Sorry, cache. Ah, cache. So cache is actually much closer to cache, so that would be better than cache. Yeah, I had Latin in school, not French, so I'm always not sure. Okay, so we have a control unit which declares a cache hit or cache mid, but it can only do so if it has some actual memory. And we said before that we have cache blocks and cache lines, but we now have to decide how they are actually structured. So there's the cache organization problem and more specifically the placement problem, because a cache is always smaller than the memory it gets access to. So I somehow have to decide where I'm placing the actual data. And the identification problem is, if I'm now trying to find data in my cache, I somehow need to determine where should I find it, or is the data I have found actually the data I'm looking for? It's a bit like a Where's Waldo problem, but on a machine level. Okay, so three organization forms are known, which are called direct mapping, full associative, or fully associative mapping, should probably say, and N-way associative, or set associative mapping. The truth is, there are not three forms, but just one form, which is the N-way associative mapping, and these two forms are special cases of this mapping. But we are still acting as if there were three forms, because this is easier to explain. And we will start with direct mapping. And the good thing is we will start with this next week, because this week we did start at 12:05 or 12:05. So it's now 1:05, which is 1.5 minutes. I thank you very much for your attention. And I hope to see you tomorrow for the exercises.